Good morning, everyone. My name is Ahmed Zahir. I'm a senior clinical fellow at Oxford University Hospitals and an ACICM NEXT committee member. Today is another ACICM collaboration podcast. Today, our guest speakers are Prof. Ramanathan, who is an associate professor in adult cardiac intensive care at the National University Heart Center in Singapore. He had his specialty training in cardiac anesthesiology from India and is trained in intensive care medicine from Brisbane in Australia. Prof. Ramanathan is closely associated with the National ECMO Standing Committee at the Ministry of Health in Singapore. Also, he currently leads the courses work group at the ECMO Education Committee at the Euro-ELSO organization. Our next speaker is Christopher, or Chris, who is a junior researcher who recently graduated from the Yong Loo Lin School of Medicine in or at the National University of Singapore. He works with Professor Ramanathan closely on multiple projects and has a huge interest in research relating to the fields of critical care cardiology. We will discuss today the recent review article in one of the most important topics in our daily practice as a cardiac intensive care doctors, which is mechanical circulatory support for cardiogenic shock, a network meta-analysis of randomized control trials and propensity score match studies. But before starting, I would like to welcome my colleague, Katerina, who is a NEXT committee member and who will co-moderate with me this interesting topic. Welcome, Katerina. Can you please introduce yourself?
Good morning. My name is Katerina. I'm coming from Latvia, and I am an ICU physician working in Riga East Clinical University Hospital, also as an ECMO team lead, and I have a great passion in ECMO.
Thank you, Katerina. So before starting, we would really appreciate our dear listeners to fill the survey after listening to our valuable podcast. Help us improve our quality of our educational podcast. Let's start by asking. So, Professor Ramanathan, what was the clinical and research initiative in creating the meta-analysis?
Well, Ahmed, to be honest, really at the outset, we need to understand that the use of mechanical cardiac support devices in cardiogenic shock is not new. It's been there for some time now. And despite various mechanical cardiac support devices that we have been using in cardiogenic shock, the overall mortality in cardiogenic shock remains anywhere between 40 to 50%, irrespective of the device, irrespective of the RCTs that have been conducted on it. You need to understand that, you know, when a clinician does an RCT on MCS device, which essentially gets done when the or gets established when the patient is not or doing well or is in extremis, there are a lot of challenges to do an RCT, especially placebo-controlled RCTs with mechanical assist devices can be difficult. And you also need to understand that to standardize the use of such devices in randomized controlled trials in terms of device management, the timing of initiation, everything has its set of challenges. And there are a lot of questions unanswered as to what is the optimal MCS device that's available for treatment in cardiogenic shock. And as I said earlier, despite the findings of whatever trials that have gone through so far, the overall outcomes in cardiogenic shock has not improved in the last 25 years. So there was an utmost need to figure out where we stand in terms of use of these devices. We needed to figure out why these devices were not working. And also we needed to figure out which device comes nearest to good or even offering better outcomes compared to the others. However, you know, in in the context of collating such a literature, we understand that there would be a lot of limitations too. So we were trying to, you know, get the best evidence possible in terms of what is available in literature to sum up which MCS device works in cardiogenic shock and which doesn't.
Yes, thank you for your answer. I would like to ask one more question, but more related to the criteria that you had in this paper. Could you tell a little bit more about both the inclusion and exclusion criteria of this paper?
Yeah. So essentially, you know, while working towards a meta-analysis, a review and a meta-analysis, we realized that there are multiple devices that are being used in cardiogenic shock. That's where we thought about getting a network design for this particular meta-analysis. Our inclusion and the criteria was quite simple. Any RCT that or a high grade propensity score matched study that compares a MCS device with another MCS device or with medical therapy in cardiogenic shock would be included in this study. I mean, that essentially would mean that, you know, we would be getting some of the best studies that would, again, form the basis of our analysis when we chalk out the topmost part of the pyramid of evidence, which is a systematic review and meta-analysis. Now, to achieve that, we had an a priori analysis plan that was registered with Prospero. Essentially, we looked at Medline, Embase, and Scopus databases for a period of about more than 30 years, from 1990 till 2023. We had about 48,000 patients who were in the severe form of cardiogenic shock, what we call as the SCAI stage, C to E stage of cardiogenic shock, who received various kinds of mechanical cardiac support devices or did not receive them at all. And we had the opportunity to do the analysis on this cohort.
Thank you, moving on. Chris, could you explain to our listeners and our intensivists the model which was used in the paper called the GRADE approach, was used to analyze the data, and what makes this approach you have used in your paper helpful to your meta-analysis?
Thank you for that, Dr. Ahmed. So I think I'd just like to start by thanking everyone for being here today and thankful for the opportunity to be able to share a bit more about this research. So if I understand correctly, your question is about the GRADE approach. So just to talk a little bit about the GRADE approach, GRADE actually stands for Grading of Recommendations, Assessment, Development, and Evaluations. And it was developed to be an approach to rate the certainty of evidence in systematic reviews and other evidence synthesis. And by allowing us to rate the certainty of evidence, it therefore allows us to potentially make clinical practice recommendations based on these reviews. And it's the most widely adopted tool for grading the quality of evidence and making recommendations, with many organizations worldwide endorsing GRADE. So when I talk about certainty, the certainty of evidence in GRADE ranges from high certainty, moderate certainty, low and very low. And how we appraise the certainty is based on several factors, such as indirectness of the result, the study type, imprecision, as well as whether or not there's a large effect, as well as several other parameters that the great users. And there are automated tools as well online that can assist us in helping us rate the certainty of evidence. And therefore, we can make a judgment on the strength of evidence for each intervention. So I'll just elaborate a little bit with an example. So for example, I'm going to use the example of our main outcome in this paper. So mortality between the ECMO and IABP group against the no cardiac circulatory support group. So we found that a large part of the results and the patients included in the results were more from the propensity score match studies as opposed to randomized control trials. And as I'm sure the listeners are aware, randomized control trials are considered the gold standard. and while propensity score match studies are high quality as well, they might not be as much of a gold standard as randomized controlled trials. And so for that reason, we downgraded the certainty of evidence for that intervention. However, with regards to that intervention, we also found that ECMO IABP, when compared to no cardiac circulatory support, there was actually a large effect of improvement in mortality with ECMO IABP. Therefore, after downgrading the evidence, we were subsequently able to further upgrade the evidence due to the presence of this large effect. And so this is basically what GRAID does. It allows us, based on multiple parameters, to come up with the most balanced certainty level for the evidence. And this helps us in whether or not we can significantly push for clinical practice recommendations. So that's basically the overview of GRAID. And how this helps us with the meta-analysis is that, and how this sort of makes our meta-analysis a little bit different, is that, well, GRAID is normal and it's quite commonly used, but how ours may differ is that in a network meta-analysis, as opposed to a conventional meta-analysis, we can incorporate direct and indirect estimates in the network meta-analysis, and GRAID helps us to do that. So what do I mean by direct and indirect estimates? So a direct estimate is basically, there's a paper that compares ECMO against no MCF, and we have all the papers that compare ECMO against no MCF, and that's a direct estimate. An indirect estimate would be if there are no papers comparing, for example, ECMO IABP against no MCS, but there are papers comparing ECMO IABP against ECMO. So since there are papers comparing ECMO against no MCS and also papers comparing ECMO IABP against ECMO, we can therefore make an indirect estimate of the ECMO IABP group against the no mechanical circulatory support group. So it is with this direct and indirect estimate that GRAID allows us to properly appraise the certainty of evidence for groups that may not have direct comparisons between the included studies. And therefore, weighing up the effect of both direct and indirect analysis, we can then come to a conclusion on overall strength of the evidence and therefore decide on how much we can push for possible recommendations based on the review.
Thank you. Christopher, for such a great answer, but could you emphasize more, why did we use propensity score mesh studies?
So that's a good question. And in fact, before we published the paper, this was a common question posed to us by some of the reviewers as well. So we understand that generally the gold standard is to include randomized clinical trials in the literature. And it is essentially pretty much the gold standard in terms of certainty of evidence compared to observational studies, which technically propensity score match studies fall under. However, we are also aware that we need to balance this between the availability of the literature. So in short, there was a relative paucity of randomized clinical trials in the literature. And therefore, we felt that including propensity score match studies will allow us to improve the precision of our estimates. And then we balance this against the possibility that observational studies may be a lower grade of evidence. So we did our research on our end, and we found that there's actually a significant a portion of literature that suggests that results obtained from propensity score match studies, when conducted appropriately, can emulate the estimates of a randomized controlled trial very closely. And these are some studies published in various journals. And this approach has been conducted in other studies before this current one that is published. And therefore, we believe that this is still a viable approach to use propensity score matched studies. And we feel that while propensity score matched studies can be considered observational studies, which are of a lower grade of evidence, there's a significant difference between propensity score match studies and other ordinary observational studies, in the sense that propensity score match studies tend to identify certain characteristics of both groups and tries to match them in a one-to-one ratio. And therefore, this reduces a lot of the problems that we see in other observational studies, such as the effect of confounders. And in addition, when we did our analysis, we tried to identify there were significant differences between the results of propensity score match studies and RCTs. So we did a subgroup analysis, and we found that the interaction p-value was not significant between RCTs and propensity score match studies. And therefore, we found that while some might have an issue with including propensity score match studies with RCTs, we overall believe that when balancing against the benefits to our result and also the comprehensive nature of our analysis, we believe that including propensity score match studies was still a viable approach.
Thank you, Chris, for this valuable answer. So moving on, what were the strengths of this meta-analysis?
So this is a great question. Generally, I think with regards to all systematic reviews and meta-analysis, the most important strength of any systematic review and meta-analysis would be that of the methodology that was employed. And on our end, for myself and for Prof. Ram, we believe that the protocol and the methodology of our meta-analysis is robust. And we believe this to be so because we had a strict inclusion and exclusion criteria. We had a pre-registered protocol with a robust librarian verified search strategy. And we used the GRADE approach, which is a robust and holistic tool to assess the certainty of our effect estimates. Additionally, because we included both RCTs and propensity score match studies that were of high quality, the larger number of included studies can also increase the precision of our estimates and therefore allow us to have a clearer idea of the overall estimate of the interventions on mortality. Additionally, within the meta-analysis, as I touched on before, by comparing direct and indirect estimates, we could also estimate the effect between two interventions which were not directly observed, and this can only be done in a network meta-analysis. And finally, in terms of the additional aspects of our analysis, which I'll also touch on later on, we did a lot of sensitivity analysis, and we did things like individual patient data meta-analysis by reconstructing individual participant data from published survival curves, which is something that had not been done in previous or related meta-analysis on this topic. And this allowed us to better confirm the overall effect on mortality that each mechanical circulatory support strategy provides.
Thank you, Christopher, for your detailed answer. I would like to ask the next question, Professor Ramanathan. Could you explain, dear Professor, what are the limitations of the meta-analysis?
Yes, Katrina, thanks for that question. To be honest, I mean, Chris highlighted some of the strengths of this analysis. I have to confess that there were limitations too. As he rightly alluded to, given that we had included propensity score match studies, the possibility of residual confounding cannot be, excluded. So things such as a volume outcome relationship with respect to a center can never be measured. And the second thing was, the second limitation I would think was the amount of clinical heterogeneity. So, different institutions would have variable inclusion criteria, though we all agree on the fact that stage C to E, at some point you would need a MCS device in cardiogenic shock. The point of initiation can be quite heterogeneous. A third point I would like to highlight is the fact that we actually collated all patients who were in SCAI stage shock C to E, but we couldn't get individual SCAI stages and look at the impact of MCS devices on it. And that's essentially a limitation due to study level data. So again, that's one more thing I need to highlight. We also had a higher proportion of propensity score match studies, which in fact, when we graded the certainty of evidence, we were aware of this particular limitation. And so we downgraded some of the certainties from even high to moderate, or even from moderate to low or very low. Going on to say that some of the findings of this study, which we have, may have a low to very low certainty of evidence based purely on the predominance of propensity score match studies. Again, you know, we couldn't do subgroup network meta-analysis, which the software doesn't allow. And we had grouped all the microaxial VAD devices together. So all kinds of Impella, starting with Impella 2.5 CP, Impella 3.5, Impella 5 and 5.5, were all grouped together, and it might be difficult to tease out which of these microaxial devices gave a better outcome than the rest. And the last but not the least, in patients who received combination therapy or combination devices, it's again difficult to tease out which device went in first. So, you know, this would certainly add to the list of limitations that we had in this meta-analysis. But overall, you know, we did try to overcome some of these limitations statistically, as well as making sure that, you know, the data is properly analyzed and graded.
Thank you, Prof. Ram. So moving on, Chris, would you mind telling us what were the results of this meta-analysis?
Thank you for the question. So when we did the research, there were actually quite a few aspects that we tried to address with our research. So I think maybe I'll just talk through a bit about some of the main findings that we found, and then I'll elaborate a little bit more about some of the main sensitivity analysis that we did. So obviously, the aim of our analysis was to find out which mechanical circulatory support device or which combination of these had the best outcomes in terms of mortality. And we did this via a network meta-analysis to assess all possible direct and indirect comparisons between the groups. So with regards to our main analysis, we largely compared mechanical circulatory support devices against no mechanical circulatory support devices. And we generally found that the ECMO IABP combination group was associated with lower mortality. And subsequently, when we appraised the certainty of this evidence, we found that this was of a moderate certainty. And we found that there were no significant differences in mortality between ECMO and no mechanical circulatory support, as well as with all the other mechanical circulatory support devices compared with no mechanical circulatory support. So essentially, the only intervention that did have mortality benefit against no MCS was ECMO IABP. And with regards to comparing between MCS devices, one of the more notable findings was that we found that there was actually a significant improvement in mortality when we compared ECMO IABP against the ECMO group, at the ECMO alone group. So that was something that is notable because it allowed us to make the indirect comparison between ECMO IABP and no mechanical circulatory support as well. So that was the main analysis. We also did sensitivity analysis that I alluded to earlier by conducting individual patient data meta-analysis. And from then, we were able to obtain the hazard ratios for mortality, of which we found that ECMO IABP was also the only mechanical circulatory support device associated with reduced mortality with a hazard ratio of about 0.55. Additionally, we then did what is called a trial sequential analysis, which allows us to estimate the required information size for each intervention and in each pairwise meta-analysis in order to deduce whether or not there is a subsequent information size for us to definitively conclude that there is a benefit in this intervention. And this is important because while there might be statistical significance, the estimate might not have reached the required information size for there to be a significant clinical difference when implementing these interventions. And that's why we did the trial sequential analysis, because it essentially sums up all the previous trials and finds whether or not the required information size has been achieved. Something that we found from this analysis was that the required information size was not reached for all pairwise meta-analysis between two modalities, aside from ECMO-IABP versus ECMO and IABP versus MVAT. So that was the additional sensitivity analysis that we did. We also did several secondary outcomes, which were largely based on the potential risk of mechanical circulatory support devices. So because we included a lot of interventions, it would be way too long for me to talk about each individual intervention and each individual side effect. But something that we generally noticed was that mechanical circulatory support devices, as I'm sure the viewers are aware, does come with a significantly increased associations with bleeding, as well as limb ischemia and other complications such as acute kidney injury. Although the certainties for those are again a variable, depending on the certainty of evidence between each estimate. So those are some of the key findings that we found in the meta-analysis.
Thank you, Christopher, for your answer. Now, I would like to ask Professor Ramatan, why do you think ECMO microvascular blood showed no significant reduction of mortality?
Thanks, Katrina. That's a great question. Now, let me first explain the terminologies that we used so that audience can understand what they are. So microaxial VATs are, we grouped all the impeller group or impeller devices together as MVAD or microaxial VATs. And we then had tandem heart, which was called as a centrifugal VAD or a CVAD. And we also, when we did subgroup analysis, we combined MVAD and CVAD as peripherally inserted VADs or PVADs to do a few analysis as well. So that's to clarify the kind of devices and the acronyms we used. Now, the way these devices function are entirely different. But coming to your question on why we think it didn't show any significant reduction in mortality, I got to again confess here that the non-significant findings may be due to smaller sample sizes. It may be due to the imprecision. But having said that, you know, you may also find that some of the associations which we found, especially in combination devices such as ECMO, MVAD, clearly goes against the non-significant reduction in mortality too. So yes, we did notice some complications, but clearly the reduction in mortality was not significant, even though people who use ECMO and impeller together, what is called as the ECMELA or the ECPELA concept, have shown in single center as well as in multi-center observational studies that this device, when it is used together, has significant mortality differences. Our network meta-analysis didn't show that signal, probably because of the sample size.
Thank you, Prof. Ram. So moving on, Chris, based on the above results, do you think that we can have a clear consensus in implementing left ventricular offload devices such as intra-aortic balloon or MVADs during the initiation and establishment of the ECMOs?
Thank you for this question. So I think that, of course, it would be tempting for us to make recommendations, but actually on our side, our research group would actually encourage that we approach this issue in a prudent fashion. And we don't believe that recommendations can really be made based on the results of our analysis specifically. And this is for several reasons. So, well, obviously, we found that there's a moderate certainty in improvement of mortality when we use ECMO with IABP. We do have to note that there are no real large-scale randomized controlled trials that directly compare ECMO-IABP against no MTS. Additionally, as I alluded to before, against the trial sequential analysis, we also found that while we did reach the required information size for ECMO IABP against ECMO, ECMO against no MCS did not reach the required information size. And therefore, it might be difficult for us to infer too much based on this indirect estimate of ECMO IABP against no MCS. So I think that it would be prudent for us to take a step back. And we believe that the value of our analysis in this sense would be more of a hypothesis generating one, in the sense that, firstly, we think that it helps to address some of the results of the current RCTs. So previously, findings from RCTs comparing ECMO against no mechanical circulatory support show that there is no improvement in our mortality. And this is something that we confirmed with our analysis. And on our side, we think that this can be due to a variety of factors, including the increased afterload on the heart itself during the implementation of ECMO due to significant back pressure effects. And we think that the study highlights that an offload device, such as an IABP, may potentially help to offset some of these effects. And I think that therefore, our analysis is more hypothesis generating, and it demonstrates that there is room for a new hypothesis that can guide further trials. And clearly, we can see that it is worth exploring ECMO with an offload device against no mechanical circulatory support, even though current trials do suggest that ECMO against no mechanical circulatory support in its current state does not have improved mortality. So we think that the value of our analysis is not so much to push towards a consensus in the implementation of ECMO with IABP, but rather to help guide further trials and to demonstrate and basically be more hypothesis generating in the future. And we hope that this is something that we can see in the future with more trials comparing offload devices against offload devices with ECMO. Yep.
Thank you, Christopher. I would like to address the next question to Professor Ramatan. And how do you think, what is the role of Impella as left ventricular offload device during ECMO runs?
Yeah, great question, Katerina. We recently had the danger shock study published, which looked at Impella as a first-line device in cardiogenic shock. And over a period of 10 years, they showed that this was one of those devices that showed mortality benefits. So clearly, you know, I'm not going into the details of the trial and the inclusion and exclusion criteria of it. I can see a role for Impella as an MCS device. Specifically to your question, would Impella be useful as a ventricular offload device during ECMO? I would think yes. As I said earlier, there have been a lot of observational data and propensity match studies that have shown that Impella with ECMO, as they call it, the ECPella or the ECMella, reduces the duration of ECMO, duration of ICU stay, and even improves mortality. So, but we got to understand that, you know, this comes from observational studies, which are retrospective. So we need to look at the upcoming studies that addresses specifically this problem. So the ANCHOR study and the UNLOAD LV study are looking at some of the unloading devices to be used during ECMO, and one of them uses Impella. And I think that would provide more insights into this combination device of ECPella being used as an unloading device during ECMO runs.
Thank you, Professor. And how do you think, what would be the future directions in at clinical and research practice domains?
So from a research perspective, I think our study has a few hypothesis generating scenarios. clearly, you know, we still don't know what the optimal MCS device is. The timing of initiation of such a device is again, even though we broadly say that they are best suited for the latter stages of cardiogenic shock, we clearly don't have a finite differentiation between whether this would be late stage of stage C SCI or stage D SCI. Again, these are my nuances where, you know, we need more answers to problems. The second thing in terms of how we look at this clinically would be to figure out the fact as to whether, you know, each device probably has its own domain in the management of cardiogenic shock at various stages. And just as SCI stage stratified cardiogenic shock, we may be able to stratify the use of cardiogenic shock devices as well. And that definitely needs a clinical answer. It may be something in terms of upgrading, say, from one device to the another at a particular point. That's something which we don't have clear-cut answers on. So I think, you know, these are areas which needs to be investigated further. It's difficult to do RCTs in cardiogenic shock, as I said earlier during the start of this podcast, for many reasons. I mean, of course, standardizing the use of device management institutionally versus, you know, doing placebo-controlled mechanical assist devices can be really challenging, and it can take as long as 10 years, like the danger shock trial, to complete such trials. So it's going to be difficult to design such things as we move along. But I believe, you know, we got to look at not just RCTs. We might have to look at platform models when we do clinical research in cardiogenic shock in future to see if various devices can be compared at the same time and whether they offer any survival benefits. So, yeah, I mean, overall, I think there is a lot of room for, when I say, you know, improvement. I would think there is a big scope for clinical as well as research-based answers. We do have the questions. It's just we need to translate them into proper trials and find out the answers.
Okay, Prof. Ram, unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our podcast. But before ending our podcast, we'd really appreciate from yourself and from Chris, what are the take-home messages to our listeners and our young intensivists and our young
aside from our results, I think some other take-home messages would be that we indeed can consider the use of unloading devices in conjunction with ECMO against no mechanical circulatory support and against ECMO alone. And I think that this is something to keep in mind in future clinical practice. But of course, we need to await the results of further randomized control trials in the future. Additionally, I think some other takeaway messages might be to always balance the risk of mechanical circulatory support against any potential side effects or complications, which I believe that Prof. Ram alluded to earlier when explaining why microaxial VATs, at least within the context of our research, did not have any improvements in mortality. So I think that this is always something that we need to keep in mind. So although mechanical circulatory support devices may potentially be life-saving, we need to also consider that there is a risk of things such as acute kidney injury, stroke, limb ischemias, that although life-saving might have severe functional limitations on the patients in the future. And therefore, we need to balance it when deciding when or not to initiate these things. And of course, we also have to account for center experience as well with regards to this. And I think those would be the main takeaways that I had when trying to write up the discussion for the paper as well.
Thanks, Chris. My two cents worth, Ahmed. First, of course, you know, in the context of ECMO, probably ECMO with unloading may be associated with lower mortality rates. That's been the main finding of the study. However, that doesn't mean that other MCS devices don't work. We just have to accept that these devices may confer survival benefits outside the context of the studies in which they were used. So we've not looked at it at specific scenarios where certain MCS devices have been used. And I believe, you know, by altering some of these inclusion criteria, if we get to do another trial, even if it is long enough, we may get to see a different perspective altogether. So yeah, the second message is, it's not that other MCS devices do not produce benefits. It's just that in the context of the study in which they were used, they failed to show. And even in the context of our NMAs, which is an amalgamation of all these studies put together, they didn't show a benefit. There will be specific scenarios where they might be useful, and those will be the things which we need to look for.
Thank you, Prof. Ram. Thank you, Chris. Thank you to our valuable speakers. Thank you, Katerina. Thank you all for listening to us.
Thanks, Ahmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Ahmed.
Thank you. It was a great experience.